Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, back in the 1930s and 40s, long before TV, families gathered around the big console radio in the living room for entertainment. I mean, you've got that image right in your mind. And there were musical entertainment programs like the Grand Ole Opry, you know, that swept the country, or at least the country part of the country. And there were comedy shows like Life of Riley and Amos and Andy and Fibber McGee and Molly. And of course, we all know Throckmorton P. Gildersleeve. How could we forget him? That was actually big at the time. But there were variety shows like the Texaco Star Theater and Mercury Theater, and noir dramas, kind of dark, you know, dramas like The Green Hornet and The Shadow. In fact, there are lots of those. And there seemed to be a really big appetite for scary thrillers like Lights Out and The Haunting Hour and The Whistler. And also kind of a big genre was Crime Stopper shows like Dragnet and Boston Blackie, Superman and Gangbusters. And really, there were nearly as many popular radio shows then as there are popular shows on cable TV today. And like TV shows today, people were captivated by them, and they had a huge cultural impact. I'm sure you all know about Orson Welles' show War of the Worlds in 1938, which had literally millions of people convinced that a real alien invasion of Earth was underway, and people were panicking and driving frantically around in the streets with their luggage. They didn't know where to go. So a huge number of early TV and even movie stars came out of radio. People like Jack Benny and Groucho Marx, Red Skelton, Jimmy Stewart, and Laurel and Hardy, and Abbott and Costello. I mean, it goes on and on. George Burns and Gracie Allen, Ozzie and Harriet, Milton Berle, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Dinah Shore, and a lot of other people that we knew from TV and entertainment later all got their start in radio. So you're probably wondering why I'm giving this thumbnail history of old-time radio, and it's because I want to connect it as an entertainment medium with today's podcasting. The term podcasting, I didn't really know this till I looked into it recently, was only invented in 2004, and it's a combination of iPod and broadcasting. I didn't know that part. Remember iPods, little devices that would play MP3 files? But podcasting didn't really take off until around 2005 or just after that, when Apple added podcast support to its iTunes. And obviously one parallel between old-time radio and podcasts is that, like radio, podcasts are strictly audio, and most of the time they're free. Paid for by advertising, like radio. And like the radio shows of the past, they're series, and always with the same type of content and usually the same host, and they exist in a myriad of different genres and topics, like we were just describing. So people follow them like people 80 or 90 years ago followed their favorite radio programs, and of course like people follow TV shows today as well. And one big difference with radio is that they can be played by the listener anytime, anywhere. You don't have to be parked in front of the radio in your living room. But one way in which podcasting is starting to converge even more with old-time radio is in the emergence, kind of more recently, of whole dramatic programs, like sitcoms and drama series with actors and theme songs and sound effects and the whole thing that you'd see on TV. Not just opinion talk shows, but podcast plays, like radio plays. Now, my guest has probably been wondering when I'd finally get around to him in the show, and now we finally have. His name is Ryan Terry, and he's the creator and host of a new podcast called Four's a Crowd. Welcome, Ryan. Why don't you tell us about Four's a Crowd?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me, Court. It's a pleasure to get down and speak with you about Four's a Crowd. Four's a Crowd is a completely scripted sitcom podcast, and it's about four 30-somethings who share an apartment after heartbreak and skyrocketing rent force them together in a subversive, no-holds-barred, coming-of-age comedy. We subvert a lot of the idea of what we're used to when we're talking about coming of age. Because typically when you think coming of age stories, movies, you think of kids that are 10, 11, 12 years old, maybe some, you know, teenage coming of age stories. But you don't think of coming of age in your 30s. In our culture, in which individuals are increasingly living with their families a lot longer, It's taking much longer to get married or have a long-term relationship. There is this idea that you encounter a lot of obstacles and a lot of unique traumas in your 30s. And I wanted to explore that in a coming-of-age fashion. And I do that through the classic sitcom packaging, but the characters are incredibly modern. It's a modern story, contemporary references, but it's told through the tools that were used by sitcoms, which were the king of television for over 50 years. And it's a show that has been very well received, and I'm happy to work with the cast I do. And it's been a lot of fun, and I continue to look forward to where it's going to go from here.
Yeah, so you're skirting around. I've listened to a couple episodes, and you're skirting around kind of the core of it, which is that it's a gay-themed sitcom. And it really is, you know, you said it's kind of reflects an adult program like some of the sitcoms in the past, but a little different. But really, to me, it's a lot like Seinfeld. I mean, that was kind of a, I don't know, you know, there were a bunch of single coming-of-age young adults who were trying to figure out who they were still. And it's very much like that. But instead of that kind of heterosexual group of people, it's more a gay-themed thing. And it really reminds me of Three's Company. You know, it's Four's a crowd, so it's kind of an extrapolation of Three's a Company, right? And, you know, I don't watch sitcoms much, but I did watch a couple episodes of that back in, I don't know what, the mid-80s or early 80s or so. And I think that was a guy who had to pretend to be gay in order to be allowed to be a roommate with two women because he didn't have a place to live and they had enough space to squeeze him in and they needed, you know, the help with the rent or whatever. So there was kind of that aspect, an early version of that theme going on with Three's Company, which is maybe extrapolated a little more in Four's a crowd. In fact, was that intentional? Did you kind of take off from Three's Company, Ryan?
Sure, that's a great question. While those two shows didn't particularly influence in any direct fashion Four's a crowd, there are definitely sitcoms that inspired characters and plots and the overall experience of the show. And those are The Golden Girls, Frasier, The Nanny, Will and Grace, and some others. Though our show is incredibly comedic, we really do our best to tell the stories that don't always get to be told, especially these stories from underrepresented groups in mainstream television and radio programming, hence why we have characters with different sexualities, different stages in life, different relationship statuses, because these are people that really exist out there, and we want this to be a platform in which we can explore those ideas and tell those stories. Many sitcoms have a core cast of four characters, and you usually have a fifth reoccurring, you know, maybe in most of the episodes. And so it's four, and they're living together, but as you can imagine, it gets very crowded, even in a spacious apartment. And the apartment this group lives in is one of those unrealistic sitcom apartments that could never exist in real life. And so it kind of came from you thinking, like, one's lonely, two's a couple. Three's Company, we know that from the little axiom or maxim we have in our linguistics and also from the TV show, but I wanted to take it a step further. Four's a crowd. And so that's where the name of the show came from. And the title came to be not only through the pilot script, but also the brilliant vocalist and composer Lana White, who is responsible for our catchy theme song. And I sat down with her when we're collaborating on the theme song, and it came up in a conversation. And I said, that's it.
Well, it's pretty impressive if you weren't really directly influenced by either Seinfeld or Three's Company that you came up with something that really, to my mind, when I listened to it, sounds very similar. So you kind of, you know, those were both big, big hits. So you've kind of hit independently on a similar creative level of theme that hopefully will end up being as successful in the podcast world as they were on TV. So, but you mentioned the theme song, and you know, there are a lot of the elements of a sitcom in this podcast, right? There's a laugh track and all the things we're used to on TV sitcoms, but why don't we just play the theme song since we've teased everybody by talking about it, and it is pretty catchy. So let's go ahead and run that one. You know, as I said, I hope everybody agrees, that is a catchy theme song, and it's really well done. It's very professional, and I did notice, by the way, that there's a reference to Three is More Like Company in there, and so again, that gave me the idea that it took from that, so that was funny that you kind of went in parallel with that show title from back, 30-some-odd years ago, I guess. So in the show, how long is each episode, Ryan?
great question, because podcasts come in all sorts of runtimes, all sorts of lengths. And many of the podcasts that I listen to, which are a lot of film and horror podcasts, a lot of them run around an hour or so. Well, I knew for this podcast to truly capture the structure and magic of a sitcom, it needed to be a half an hour, just like they were on TV. So that is what you get with Four's Crowd, is a half hour show. Sometimes it's a little bit longer. Our Thanksgiving episode and Christmas episodes are a little bit longer. But the idea is to target a half an hour. One, it matches up with the classic sitcom format. Two, it works very well in a commute, whether you're in your own car, you're on the subway. It works well if you're sitting at a gate waiting for your airplane, you're on your lunch break. So there's so many places where people listen to podcasts that a half hour show is just the thing they need to fill in the time. And you don't feel that you have to plan or dedicate time to it. It's just, it fits in with whatever you're already doing.
No, I agree with you. I think that's a good choice. You know, and of course, you know, like you can with TV, if you're sitting and watching TV, you can stop and start and pause it, and, you know, assuming you've got, you know, a cable and so on. But so you can listen to it in bites. But if you had it an hour long, by the time you got through listening to it in 10-minute bites, you'd have forgotten how it started, kind of thing. So I think half an hour is probably as much as you could take it. How many actors are involved?
I have a cast from the UK all the way to San Diego in my show. And I found them through networking, through Twitter. Twitter is the platform for podcasters. That's where podcasters hang out. You know, that's where I spend a lot of my time. And I just put out a feeler for actors. I had character bios and descriptions and, you know, starting a podcast, looking for talent. And word just got around. I had a lot of people audition and pick the right actors. And I wound up with a cast, again, from the UK to San Diego. A lot of the cast is here in Central Florida, but my narrator is in the UK. One actor's in Seattle, the other's in San Diego, and then the rest of us are here in Florida. It's really amazing that a content creator can connect with so many different people with, it takes work, it just doesn't happen, but you put in the work and there's the potential to meet all these people. And I have been just thrilled to work with all of them. And we get together, we have fun. And I think that's why the show has been, one reason why it's been so well received is people listen to it and you can tell that the cast is having fun.
Yeah, so that's obviously a big difference between obviously the really old radio shows and even TV, where they have to be there in person. And, you know, that's been a big hit during the coronavirus era, that, you know, people can't produce TV shows like they used to because they have to get together and it's tough to do. And yet a podcast you can do, as you just described, with people from all over the world who've never met in person and yet get to know each other through the show and online. And, and, you know, I guess you probably Zoom with each other and so on and that kind of thing. But it's just it eliminates the logistical difficulty and the expense of having to do it all in one place, which is a huge, huge difference. And it makes it possible to do. So I gather that you're obviously the creator. So there must be a producer and a writer, too, because you work from a script, I guess. And so tell us about that aspect of it. Do you wear all those hats, or are they kind of parceled out?
Sometimes. No, I've got a great producer and a co-writer. I created the original concept of the show, to give a little history here, dates back to 2013 or 14 when I wrote the first draft of the script. Intended it to be on TV. That didn't work out. Intended it to be a web series. That didn't work out. And then it sat in my computer for years. And then back in March, when I found myself, as many people did, just sitting at home, it's like, well, I could use this time to be constructive. And I did. And it hit me that, you know, I've been putting the show off for a long time, always focused on what I didn't have, what I couldn't do for one reason or another. And over the years, I've built up a little bit of a following, a fandom on hashtag film Twitter and within the Podern family. And that's what we call podcasters. It's a sort of modern family. It's hashtag Podern family. And so I was invited to speak on a lot of shows, a lot of great podcasts. I've made dozens and dozens and dozens of guest appearances talking about film, or my particular area of expertise is actually horror, even though we're talking about comedy today. But comedy and horror use a lot of the same tools. It's just tweaked a little bit differently. And so I have this network sitting right at my fingertips, and it hit me. I I can take this show, which is dialogue driven anyway, and I can adapt it to a podcast. That's where it started. So it sat in the computer for a long time until we got to March, April. And then between March, April and the show's premiere, which was the August 29th, got everything together within that relatively short amount of time. My producer is Danielle Meskel. She just got married, so I'm trying to get used to her new last name. She's been associated with the show since I wrote the first draft. And then Zachary Rohr is my co-writer. He's a writer and podcaster, and so another creative individual. And the way we break it up is I write every other episode. Zach writes every other episode. I recently attached an editor to my show. He's doing a great job, so I feel confident that we're going to continue working with him. Danielle manages all of the communication with the cast, our Facebook, our TeePublic store. We're launching our Patreon very soon. She produces the show. So I may have created it, but I certainly couldn't do it without Zach writing every other episode as I write every other episode and Danny doing her thing.
Yeah.
The logistics of the show just wouldn't come together otherwise. And so they're very much at the core outside of our talented cast, what makes the show work.
Yeah, so I think a lot of, you know, at least my impression is that a lot of podcasts are just one person, you know, ranting and, you know, it's just kind of a talk show in a way. And maybe they have somebody doing production, but it sounds like you've got a real crew here. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a real team of people putting this together and doing the social media and everything else that goes along with it. So overall, I mean, just kind of in a ballpark way, how much preparation does each episode take, including the taping and the post-production? Is it a two-week process, you know, involving everybody's halftime, you know, that kind of thing? Give us just an idea of that.
The long and short of it is it's a really a four-week process. Table read, 2 weeks later, record, 2 weeks later, we upload it to Podbean, who is our host, and Podbean connects us with the various podcast platforms, and then the show is in your ears.
Well, it sounds like a lot of work, especially if some people have regular jobs. They must sometimes feel overworked. Speaking of work, you're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with podcast creator Ryan Terry, whose podcast is called Four is a Crowd, and it's a fairly new kind of creation, and it's just been coming on and gaining audience and popularity. Tell you what, we've been teasing people all along here, Ryan, our listeners, with what the podcast sounds like and so on. We heard the theme song earlier, but why don't we play just a short clip from one of your recent episodes?
Dylan must have forgotten his keys again.
He's really got to stop leaving his keys on half the bedside tables in the city.
Well, if anything ever goes missing in here, we only have a few hundred people we'll have to track down.
Standing at the door is Mrs. Halverson, dressed as a candy striper from the hospital.
Hiya, kids. Oh, my Lanta, what are you three gloomy gusses doing at home on a Friday night? Shouldn't you be out sowing your wild, youthful oats?
Sorry, my oat spreader is in the shop.
Well, of course it is when you constantly look like you should be eating a tub of Ben and Jerry's and watching Beaches.
Why are you dressed like you should be giving me directions at the hospital?
Did my anonymous complaints about the real see you next Tuesday building concierge finally get you fired?
No more than my fake Tinder profile has ruined your reputation around town.
That was you saying that I robbed my dates after tying them up?
Simmer down, guys. Mrs. H., why are you dressed like this?
Well, you know how Mr. Halverson used to volunteer to answer phones at the Community Encouragement Center?
Used to? I thought he still did.
Well, last week he received an excited caller saying, I've decided to do it, I'm gonna do it. And Mr. Halverson kept telling the caller they could do it and to go for it because they only live once.
What's wrong with that?
Well, he accidentally answered the kleptomania hotline. Four people died during an armed robbery. Now, Mr. Halverson isn't allowed to volunteer there anymore or foster a Sarah McLachlan puppy. I just had to get out of the house before he drove me crazy.
Is this story going anywhere?
Sometime before you die, Mrs. H.
Careful. I might come back as your personal poltergeist. Anyway, I was reading the weekly community magazine, and I saw an ad for a volunteer position at the hospital in the orthopedic ward that sounded fun. So I show up at the hospital in my old showgirl's costume with a can of doggy chow and...
You showed up to the hospital dressed as an exotic dancer?
How was I supposed to know the ad said candy striper, not stripper candy? Damn dyslexia.
Just then, Dylan bursts into the apartment with a visible look of excitement on his face.
Guys, I just figured out a way to meet more dates.
More dates? Any more, and I'm gonna have to install a deli counter number thingy.
Well, if it's anything like the DMV, that queue may go out the door.
I wouldn't worry. He'll go through them faster than Netflix goes through original series.
Anyway, where are these dates?
The community theater. They're holding auditions for Death Becomes Him. It's a gender-bent production of Death Becomes Her.
Oh, please. That community theater sucks. Cam, you remember the last show we went to there, right?
Yeah, we went there for The Sound of Pop Music, and when the Von Snapp family was hiding from the angry torch and pitchfork-wielding Puritans in the YMCA, the audience kept yelling, "They're in the basement! They're in the basement!"
They found someone new to direct this show.
Well, you kids have fun. I've got to make dinner for me and Mr. Halverson. He has such a hard time putting the Stouffer's in the oven ever since the time he locked himself inside.
How did...
Don't you even ask.
Okay, well, that was cool. So now we have a good idea of what it kind of sounds like. I would say it's like clever, fast-paced dialogue. You know, again, kind of Seinfeld-esque a little bit and a tad corny in places, but that could be me. I don't know. And, you know, but mainly it's snappy, witty patter, you know, so it's that kind of a sitcom format, really, you know, and that's what you'd expect. And I noticed there's a narrator with a British accent. Is it unusual to have a narrator in show-type podcasts? Because, you know, most sitcoms don't have that. They just have the actors talking, right? So is that kind of a common theme? And is this something you'll do in all your episodes?
Yeah, the narrator is very important because he is able to communicate to the audiences what would usually be communicated to the audiences visually. I needed to be able to communicate that somehow because it's not enough just to hear people talking, because we have to know what they're doing. And so that's where the narrator came from, was birthed out of what is typically the narrative description in a screenplay, and I change it up so it reads as a character.
Sure.
And he communicates to us what they are doing within this world. He paints a picture of their environment, where they are in the apartment, what they're doing. Whereas when you're sitting around talking about movies for an hour, well, I mean, you don't need a narrator. It's an opinion show.
Yeah, good point. It's another parallel with old-time radio, because you got to have somebody to paint that picture of the context, like you said. So anyway, well, gosh, all in all, it's quite a production to do in a shoestring, and I'm assuming, you know, you don't have $1 million, multi-million-dollar budget or anything of the sort. So when did your first one air?
The first episode aired on August 29th.
Of 2020. And so how long did it take to get to that point, just roughly? I mean, I think you said you started in March or April, so a few months to get to the first one, right?
Yeah, so if you don't count any of the time that it kind of sat in limbo, which went from, we'll say, April to August, from start to finish, which is pretty quick for a scripted show, but, you know, we had a lot of time on our hands.
Yeah, right.
And we made it happen because it's like, we're going to do this. Let's do this. And we're, nothing's going to, you know, stand in our way. We're going to take that scary leap, which is when you actually put it out there for people. It's like standing naked in front of an audience, which is difficult if you don't look like an Adonis. So you, you know, we put it out there, just see what happens. And before we knew it, we were gaining followers on Twitter, subscribers through various platforms. We have people that just absolutely love listening to the show, and it means a lot to them, especially because there was a lot of darkness, a lot of negativity associated with the pandemic. And so on TV, it's a lot of what you would see and hear in radio. And I wanted the show to be a bright spot. I wanted the show to bring joy to people. I wanted to hear people laugh again. And it's been able to do that and do it in spades.
So how many shows did you end up doing in your first season? And like, when did that end?
15 episodes in season one. And again, all about a half an hour. And they're available for waiting, listening ears. Which is pretty in line with a lot of streaming shows. Many streaming shows are, if it's an hour long show, it's 10 episodes. Half hour shows typically have a bit more, but it fits right in line with TV structure.
And are you working on season two?
Already working on season two. The production process never ends. Always be in some state of production, whether that's pre-production, principal production, or post. So already thinking of our season two episodes and where we would like to take the show.
So I guess in your downtime, you know, you'll go spend time in the Caribbean and, you know, just really relax. Just kidding there. So, yeah, what kind of, you know, you mentioned how your audience is growing, and do you have a way to measure the size of the audience at all, by the way? I mean, is it just a wild guess or just that it's getting bigger? I mean, you know, can you get any kind of idea?
Sure. Podbean, our host, makes it easy because on the dashboard, it lists for us the number of people that have downloaded the show across various platforms. So we can have a real number to go off of, in which we are seeking sponsors, for example, because sponsors want to know how many people have downloaded the show, how many people stream the show, and what you're following like. And they want to see real numbers. And so our podcast host makes getting those numbers really easy because it's right there. And then we can communicate those numbers to whomever needs the information.
Okay. So that leads, you know, we're coming to the end of the show here, Ryan. I've just got a couple of minutes left at most. But is there a subscription cost for the podcast?
No. The podcast, like many podcast, is completely free. We do have a Patreon. Patreon is a way that you can pay for additional content. It's also a fan's way, a patron, to support the show financially. So with Patreon, you get bonus content like blooper reels, some behind the scenes information, and which isn't available to the general public who's getting the show for free. So there is reason to become a Patreon member because you get a lot of additional content. We also have a TeePublic store, which you can buy your merch. We have a couple of different designs, and you can put it on a variety of merchandise, and TeePublic makes that real simple for artists. And anytime you buy something from TeePublic, for example, a portion of the money goes to the artist. So it's a great way for independent artists to actually make money off of their art. And so between TeePublic and Patreon, those are ways to financially support the show. But you can't run a podcast solely on Patreon and TeePublic merchandise, especially when it's a podcast like ours and you would like for the podcast to pay for itself. And so we're in the process of seeking sponsors for our show. And sponsors we've identified are those that already have products or services geared towards our target public, which is largely 20, 30, 40 somethings that are probably in the queer community, don't have to be. So we selected companies that want to reach those individuals. It's just start conversations and hope for the best, but you miss 100% of the shots that you never make. So we're out there and making those shots.
Well, you sound like you're really off and running and on your way, Ryan. And, you know, I urge people to go download Four as a Crowd, and you can get it at Apple Podcast. I guess it used to be iTunes, but now Apple Podcast and on Spotify. And tell me if I'm missing a couple real quickly, because we're going to have to run here.
Sure. Podbean, Google Podcast, Amazon, many platforms. The two most popular platforms, you know, are Apple Podcasts and Spotify, but there's a large number of people that do listen through Podbean, Google Podcast, and others. If your listeners are looking for a way to interact with our show, they can easily interact with us on Twitter at ForzaCrowdPod, and listeners can connect with me on Twitter at RLTerry1.
And again, it's Forza Crowd, the podcast Forza Crowd, and we've been talking with Ryan Terry. Thanks a lot, Ryan, for being on with us and filling us in on all of the world of podcast shows. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.